Now, I have something that I would like you to do, and I would like you to do it for yourselves. If you wish to pursue this course, in other words, come to all five classes, I think that an investment of your time outside of the class is well worthwhile. One of the things that is suggested by people who study Kabbalah as being a very powerful way to lock yourself into the pattern that is the Tree of Life is to make your own representation of it. Now, this thing here, just because I like Photoshop, is what I did to make my own representation of it. And, you know, it did help me better understand it. What I did was to take all of the things that I knew about each of the spheres and, to the greatest extent that I could, put them into this one image. And, you know, if I were doing it today, it would look a little bit different than it does because my understanding has moved on a little bit. And what I'm talking about is not an art project. And if you're art phobic, there's no reason not to do something. You know, I'll give you an idea of the kinds of things that people have done to make their own representation of the Tree of Life. Some very inventive lady up in New Jersey came to one of our events. She came to the Climbing Tree event with 10 cakes that she'd baked representing the 10 spheres. And
they were flavored with things that corresponded to the spheres.
Yes. Oh, I didn't realize that because I don't eat cake. But
they had correspondences.
Oh, uh-huh.
They were
and,
very pretty.
And another person got some wooden discs from Home Depot or something and painted the sigils of the 10 spheres onto those. So a pencil on a piece of paper from a notebook, or, you know, finger paints or watercolors or cutouts of construction paper or something
cross-stitching,
embroidering, anything.
Sculpey's
great. Sculpey's a great way to make things. But something that will give you a tactile impression of this, because I'm sure you realize that taking notes on things helps a lot, because you can go back and you can read your notes and you can remember kind of what was said. I say kind of because that's what happens to me. I only kind of remember what was said. But the more different senses that you incorporate into the learning of something, the better your eventual grasp will be. And there's no better way to do an understanding of Kabbalah, in my humble opinion. And you'll find this in many books that talk about Kabbalah. Then making your own Tree of Life. And, you know, if you want to do a one-off just so that you know what it feels like to draw 10 circles and connect them with lines, or if you want to make something that's a little bit more, you know, more permanent, something that you'd want to go back to time and time again, It doesn't matter to me, but I hope it matters to you, and I hope it matters to you enough to actually do this. And if you feel like it, at the end of the classes, bring in what you have done to share with other people. So does that sound too burdensome? I hope not.
I feel better. I thought you were making me say these things.
Okay, begin now, Denise. At this point, I would like to take you on a journey that was whose way was paved by the ancients, and whose path was uncovered and set down in print by Dolores Ashcroft Nowicki. This is the journey that we take twice, in it is said in life, and this is the journey on the 32nd path. And the 32nd path is the one that goes between the plane of the earth, us here, and the plane of the moon, which is called Yesod. If you refer to your chart of correspondences briefly here, you'll see over on the right-hand side where planets are referred to, the earth down there at the bottom has directly above it the moon. The moon represents the plane of the astral dreams, magic, and all of those other good things. And the journey that we take twice is the moment that we come into being at birth. And this is not necessarily the coming into the world birth, but the moment that we are ensouled, and the moment that we die. We travel back up the 32nd path to the plane of dreams. I think that's kind of a heartwarming image, but that's just, you know, my take on it. In any case, what I'd like you to do is to put your notebooks down.
Can everybody hear Mark okay? Mm-hmm. Okay.
Can you hear me okay?
No, I can't. When you drop down into a lower tone, it's very difficult to hear you. Oh, okay. And all of these words need to be heard. So.
Yeah, all right. Okay, I will speak crisply, clearly, keeping in mind my revered teacher, Ms. Ashcroft Nwiki.
Are you going
to channel her as well?
I may have no choice. She has been known to inhabit people who need to speak her words.
Oh, yes, she has.
Okay, so if you're sitting comfortably but with your carriage, close your eyes, please, and take in a deep breath. And let's go back to that place where we are connected to the column of energy that runs through our middle, runs down into the earth, runs upward into the sky, and the energies from earth and sky mingle within us, bring us into being each moment. Awareness of our normal surroundings slips away gradually, and in its place, the temple of Malkuth grows around us. It is square in shape, with a floor of black and white tiles that feel cool to our sandaled feet. The north wall is on our left, the west behind us, the south to our right. Set into these walls are circular windows of richly stained glass, each a representation of the holy creature of that quarter. In the north is a winged bull set in a circle of golden wheat and scarlet poppies. Behind us, in the west, an eagle soars into the sun through a sky of brilliant blue. In the south, a winged lion stands guard, surrounded by flames. Before us, in the eastern wall, are three heavy oaken doors. They have no handles and no locks. In front of the doors stand two pillars reaching from floor to ceiling. As we face them, the pillar on our left is made of ebony, that on our right of silver. Both are topped with a capital bearing a carved gilded pomegranate. In the middle of the temple stands the altar, a double cube of black polished wood. Covering it is a cloth of hand-woven linen on which are scattered ears of wheat. On the altar is a bowl of deep blue crystal in which burns a light. This light is to be found on every altar of the mysteries, no matter in what tradition it is set. Unless it be lit, no temple is truly contacted. The reflection of this light is carried within the heart on every journey, a protection for those who travel, and a symbol of light for those we meet in the inner worlds. Above the altar hangs a bronze lamp that burns a scented oil, filling the temple with a subtle fragrance. Behind the altar stands the figure of Sandalphon, the archangel of Malkut. He appears as a young man with dark curling hair, in which is twined clusters of grapes and vine leaves. His eyes hold a wisdom gained while the earth was still young, and a sadness that it is no longer so. His robes are a mixture of russet red, gold, and apple green. The air about him shimmers with a faint radiance, an aura of power that belies his gentle glance. We stand before the altar, making ourselves ready for the journey ahead. Then Sandalphon moves to the center door and draws in the air before it a five-pointed star. It hangs flaming for a few moments, then fades. As it does so, over the door forms a curtain depicting the tarot card of the world. It glows brighter, then becomes a three-dimensional door to the 32nd path. We walk between the pillars. The dancer hangs motionless within her wreath of leaves, and we step forward into a swirl of color. We stand in a meadow bright with flowers. To the left is a forest. On the right, cornfields dotted with scarlet poppies. Before us, the meadow slopes down to a small river with flat white stepping stones. On the other side is a limestone cliff that towers upwards. From its summit, a waterfall tumbles down to form a deep pool at its base. Behind us stand two trees with a tarot card between them. From our right, we hear the sound of weeping and see a group of women approaching through the cornfield. At their head is a woman of mature beauty, tall and deep-breasted, but with a face drawn with grief. Her long hair is loose and tangled, and she is supported on either side by another woman. As she passes over the earth, it withers and dies. Already the field behind her is parched and brown. We ask one of the group what is wrong, and we are told that the goddess Demeter is searching for her daughter, stolen by Demeter's own brother Hades, lord of the underworld. While she searches, the earth is left without her care, and all is dying. They pass into the distance, and we walk down to the river and cross over. At the foot of the cliff, by the pool, grows an ancient yew tree, half concealing the entrance to a cave lying behind the waterfall itself. This is the way we must go. The cave is cold and damp, and is lit by one small lamp on a shelf in the back. A voice speaks out of the gloom, asking our reason for entering the cave of Hecate. Our eyes, now accustomed to the dim light, see a dark-robed figure at the back of the cave. We tell the goddess that we are searching for Persephone's kingdom. Hecate rises and takes the lamp from the shelf and beckons us to follow her. At the very back of the cave is a narrow, uninviting tunnel. She points to this and tells us that this is the way to Hades, if we dare to take it. She gives us each two silver coins and the lamp, then returns to her seat to await the fall of night. The tunnel is even colder than the cave. Its floor is slippery and uneven, and we have to hold hands to prevent ourselves losing each other in the dim light from the lamp. Trickles of water run down the walls that seem to press inwards as if trying to stifle us. We have to move slowly. Sometimes the way is so low we have to bend almost double. At others, so narrow we have to force our bodies through. The wind keeps up a moaning sound that sounds like a woman in pain. This, with the constricting and tortuous path leading us ever downward, makes us feel as if we are caught up in the birth pangs of some giant entity. We stop to ease chilled limbs and hear the sound of running water. A few more steps brings us to a vast cave under the earth lit by flaring torches. Ice formations make strange shadows on the walls and hang like frozen tears from the roof far above us. Through the middle of this icy place runs a river, dark, deep, and swift flowing. It is the Styx, by which the gods swear their most sacred oaths. Its chilly waters make a natural barrier between life and death. Tied to a post on the bank is a boat, and standing by it, a man, if a man he be. Tall and broad, heavily bearded, with dark eyes that regard us unwaveringly. Despite the chill, he wears only a leather kilt and a broad belt with a leather pouch and sandals. Around him throng shadowy figures that bend and sway, their hands held out as if pleading with him. They pull and pluck at him, but their ghostly hands pass through his flesh. They are the shades of the dead, buried without the opulos, the coin that Charon, the ferryman, demands from every soul as he ferries across the Styx. Charon strides through the misty throng, pushing them aside, and gestures us to come to him. As we approach, the shades crowd about us, their voices like thin whispers in our ears. Charon makes them give way to us, and they draw back, weeping and wringing their pale hands. We enter the boat, and it is pushed out into the river. We go in silence. Only the slap of the oars on water disturbs the air. Charon bends to his blades, the sweat beading his face and beard, running down his broad chest. We are soon on the other side, and as we leave the boat, we give him one of the silver coins. He points ahead, and the light of the torches, we can see the double gates that reach up into the darkness. Set into the middle of each gate is the Hebrew letter Tau. Look at it. Fix it well into your minds, for you will see it again. The gates swing open, and we pass into the great hall hung with somber tapestries in dark reds, gray, purples, and indigo. At each end there is a raised throne of lead. On one sits Hades, lord of the underworld, and on the other, a veiled woman who wears a crown beneath her veil and carries a silver reaping hook. We come before Hades, and as we do, there is a growl from a dark shape at his feet. A black hound rises to face us, lifting not one, but three heads to watch as we approach. Three pairs of eyes fix us, and three red tongues loll between sets of teeth. The dog, Cerberus, guards his dark master. Standing in the hall of the dead, we look fearfully at its king. We see a man of great height and majestic bearing, eyes black as night, with hair and beard to match. Yet, as he leans forward, there is a hint of laughter in his eyes. His crown of jet gleams in the torchlight. The Greek tunic reveals the limbs of an athlete, not the body of an old man. He stands and steps down, inviting us to follow him. He leads us to his consort, named the dread Persephone, queen of the dead. At the approach of her uncle, lord and lover, she raises her veil, and we look into the laughing face of a young girl crowned with flowers. This is no crone with wrinkled and decaying flesh, but a woman warm with life, resting within the circle of loving arms. To this place come great and small, young and old, man and woman, going down into the dark at the appointed time to the Lord and Lady of Rebirth. These are our planetary parents from whom we receive the essences of our earth bodies. On one wall is a mirror covered with a tapestry. Hades takes us to stand before it and draws back the curtain, bidding us to look into it. The glass seems liquid and full of movement. Our minds are drawn into its depth. This is the mirror of truth, and what we see is our real and primal self, as it was before we took form, as it will be at the end of time. The curtain falls, and we are alone. Only Cerberus waits to guide us through another door and out onto the seashore under the night sky filled with stars. Above us, Saturn hangs low in the heavens, set like a jewel within its rings. The moon rises from the sea, its light making a pathway at our feet. We step forward, and the sea feels almost solid beneath us. The orb of the moon rests on the water, and we see shadowy figures moving within. Stepping from its translucent depths comes the Moon Mother herself. Robed in misty black and silver, with the crescent horns in her hair, she comes to her children, bringing with her the gift of life. She envelops us in her arms and cradles us against her breast. The scent of all the earth that's in her hair, her kiss breathes its own immortality into our mouths. Then she puts us from her, for we may not rely on her too much. We must seek our own strength. Now she is Bina, remote and calm, moving back to the moon sphere, and we return to the shore. We watch the pale orb rise into the sky, then turn at the sound of Cerberus barking. He is leaping and playing alongside his master as they walk along the shore. God and beast romp together on the shore of an endless world like any of mankind. Hound and master escort us back through the silent, empty hall and up to the icy cavern where Charon waits. He rises at our coming and accepts from us the second of the silver coins. We take our place in the boat and watch the silent figure of Hades as we draw away from the bank. The sad wraiths are huddled silently as we disembark. Next time we will ask Sandalphon to give us extra coins, with which we will buy passage for some of them each time we come. Then they will go through to the Moon Mother and rebirth. Our thanks to Charon are received, as ever, in silence, and we turn to seek the road home. Now the way is known and unfeared, and we make rapid progress. It seems only a few minutes before we are back in the cave. We replace the lamp and leave. It is night, and the moon is high as we cross the stream. Around us, the earth is full of night sounds and scents. We see Demeter and her daughter walking together in the moonlight. And with their laughter in our ears, we step through the curtain into Malkuth. Sandalphon seals the door behind us, and we stand before the altar to give thanks. With a smile, the archangel indicates a bowl of silver coins at the foot of the black pillar. We may take what we need for ourselves and the wraiths. The scene fades, and our own world builds around us. The first journey is over. Take a deep breath, and as you exhale, feel your body returning. Move your feet, your legs, your arms. Take another deep breath, and when you're ready, open your eyes. Yeah. Yes. Yes, but which Sunday? So. So this was a symbolic return to our sphere of origin. And by doing this, I believe that I've presented you with some of the imagery that is necessary for understanding how this system works. And as I've suggested, there's a lot of little nitty-gritty stuff that you're going to pretty much need to stuff into your head. And if it's not a matter of memorizing it for all time, then at least having enough of a familiarity with it so that if, as you revisit Kabbalah time after time in your career, and I'm certain that you will, because it's pretty much all around us. So once we have acknowledged the fact that it exists, it's something that we'll come into contact time after time. Do I know whereof I speak, Jim? Yes.
My recommendation for people who know absolutely nothing about Kabbalah is take the color handout home and put it in the bathroom next to the toilet and look at it every day.
Just don't let it get wet, because it's just inkjet. You know? And it'll run.
Yeah, so it'll be messy.
Yes. So, let's see. How are we doing for time here?
It is 4:25.
Okay.
You
well,
probably run over just a hair because we got started a little bit late.
Yeah. Yeah, I may have a few hairs to run over here. To get a little bit of a start on the descent down the tree, something that as you study the correspondence is something that we'll do next week. We'll run over and over again. I'll begin with the idea that the pattern that takes us from 1 to 2, and if we go back and look at the names and titles at the top of the correspondences, go to 1 to 2 to 3 to 4 to 5 to 6 to 7 to 8 to 9 to 10, this is referred to as the lightning flash. And if you take your finger and you go from 1 and you go to 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 and 7 and 8 and 9 and 10, you can see that the pattern that this traces is in the zigzag of a flash of lightning as it goes from the clouds to the earth. This is referred to as the path of return, and even though the creative force moves downward on the tree, we, as we journey into our evolving selves, as we become more aware of the greater being that we actually are, we begin to move upward on the tree. And the systems of magic that have come into being that use Kabbalah as their basis have identified places on the tree that we move to as we go through our training and our initiation from being a raw beginner to becoming a practiced adept. And I can't speak to where exactly these things are, because they do vary from school to school. But it's said that the crossing points on the tree, the horizontal bars here, the ones that go between the orange and the green and the red and the blue, those are the places where we experience a dark night of the soul. And once we have emerged from this condition where we have lost faith and descended into a kind of emotional and mental nothingness, that we emerge with a new appreciation of our divine connection, and have achieved a true initiation to another level. So this may happen to you in your lifetime as you continue to study. It's really unpleasant, but you get through it. And it's worthwhile anticipating the possibility that you will have a time when what you think now, what you believe now, what you see as beautiful now, may sometimes be as ashes in your mouth. And pushing through this with whatever force that you can bring to bear on it is entirely worthwhile, because when you see the condition that you can be brought to after having endured a dark night of the soul is worth every bit of suffering that you went through when that was happening. The worst thing that can happen to someone who gets on a magical path is that you go nowhere with it. And it's tempting to go nowhere because you get to a spot in your practice where you can consistently get some kind of a satisfying result out of doing a ritual, that you can have a great meditation or what have you, but that if it takes you someplace, it doesn't take you very far, and it doesn't take you very fast. And the only real way, and this is just not a Calvinistic overlay that for you have to be punished because of whatever. The only real way to make progress is to, once again, going back to this image that I've given you of slipping backwards, you have to slip into the darkness, into the mud, and struggle to emerge from that as the caterpillar turns into a butterfly and struggles. I mean, they don't just pop out. Those suckers got to tear the heck out of those cocoons in order to get to the outer world. And
that's after turning to goo.
That's after turning to goo. Yeah. Oh yeah, that's right. They got to turn to goo too. So, listen to me, people. You got to turn to goo.
I'm already there.
It's like you can't cross the river without the coins, but the coins were provided when we needed them.
Yes. That makes all kinds of little things fire in my head, and I don't know if I want to.
I was
going to
ask, well, like, are the coins that next bit of knowledge that you're going to come into that's going to keep you going on the path? Like you said, you come into that experience, and then you've had it, and you know that you're ready to move on to the next.
Well, you know, when you think about it, when you were handed those coins by Sandalphon, unless you've been this before, did you have any idea why you were handed coins?
Yeah.
Well, you did, because you've done it before. But the things that we're handed through our paths of learning may make sense to us at the time, or it may be only after a long and difficult journey that we begin to realize what we have here. So I've got this little silver coin in my hand, and if I didn't have it, I was going to end up like those lost wraiths over there who don't have a pot or a window, you know. So the coins, I may be handing you a coin today, but I have no way of knowing it, and neither do you. Profound, deep looks all around here.
You will have to give it up.
Exactly.
That was hard. Uh-huh. Okay.
Yes, there.
A damn cold cave.
There is an expenditure involved. Sorry, Kayla.
But you know, even if they did take Visa, you'd have to pay eventually.
Yeah,
that's true.
With interest.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Compounded interest.
Well, does any of this give rise to questions or observations or thoughts about the beginning of this journey for some, and maybe the re-beginning of this journey for others?
Just when I think I'm getting something.
Okay.
was kind of confused because I was very much like a, I'm just going to go with it. And so when we walked through the world card and I saw the green grass, and I thought, okay, well, I'm back on Earth. So I thought we were going up.
Mm-hmm.
So when we got to the end, I'm like, okay, I did the whole thing backwards.
Well, you know,
here I am back again.
Sometimes you have to go down to go up. And as a matter of fact, that's kind of the pattern. If you have, if you've ever done any explorations into the world of the Fae, most of the paths that take you to them take you downward first. And one of the things that I'm going to touch on is the parts, our parts of self. We have a lower, middle, and higher self, and we, our middle self, the thinking mind, the one that we look out at the world at, is only in the most tenuous touch with the other two. But one of the easiest ways to get to your higher self is to petition through your lower self or descend into your lower self, and it can serve sort of as that ferry boat, you know, to the place where our true self, our true spark of divinity resides. I think. Well, unless there is anything further, I'd say that that's it for today. And I thank you all for coming out.
And I,
oh, sure, yeah, yeah.
Look at this tree all the time.
Yeah, okay.
We say, as above, so below.
Yes.
So, Malkuth then, Malkuth, is actually a reflection of Keter here.
Exactly.
For us, in our
heart. Uh-huh.
So whether you're climbing it or descending doesn't really make any difference. The reason I ask is as I study the four worlds, and maybe you'll get to that later.
Yeah, I think that's next. No, it's the third week. Third week is the four worlds.
Remnant of my past understanding makes me always want to travel that direction, and I find sometimes in my path workings it does go down. I'm more responsive.
So it spontaneously goes down.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. See, that I think that's probably another bit of evidence for the for what I've suggested, that these forms, and not just the Kabbalistic forms, but a lot of other forms that we engage with on this spiritual path have been well trod. And when you start to move into that world, it's sort of like you're on rails. You have a certain latitude in your movement, but not all that much. And a lot of times, you know, you'll see things when you are in a meditative state that are completely surprising to you, that you would have no way of anticipating. Well, where do those come from? Where do those come from? And I maintain that those things are put there for our understanding. And it's only when we get to the point where our inner sight is open enough to see them that we're presented with them. So, the images that you saw on the path working today are ones that are iconic. There are things that I know that if you had any, you know, if you've had any brush with Greek mythology or some of the psychological symbolism that you've encountered before, and it's not there because humans thought of it and put it there. It's there because it's there. and we have uncovered it, and through our mythology and through our explorations of human psychology, these things have come into the space where we can talk about it, and instead of just dream about it or have dreads about it or you know what. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, if you think of questions between now and 2 weeks from now, do write them down.
Mm-hmm.
This stuff does take a while to sink in and percolate back out. We covered a lot of very large topics
Yeah.
briefly.
And you know, I've tried, but there's really no way to give you Kabbalah in a nutshell. You know, you got this tree, see, and it starts at the top and it goes down to the bottom, and it's got colors and stuff. That, no. Blank look is all that will produce, and yeah, I hope I wasn't too baffling, but you know sometimes there's just no help for it, and if there's a concept that makes you say, what the heck did he just say? Don't be afraid to ask, because I can probably come up with a different way of phrasing it. It's the what comes out of my mouth in these sessions is a product both of having looked at this for a long time, and just you know sometimes, truthfully, what I believe I don't really know until I hear myself saying it. So you know, there are probably better and more understandable ways of phrasing things that key into your understanding more than my understanding. And if you know, if you reach a point where that's so, please do ask me, and I'll writhe on the floor for a while, and then I'll get back up again and say, oh yeah, yeah. Well, how about this?
I read like half of the Witch's
Uh-huh.
Yesterday.
Oh, good.
And
you've read it before.
I've read it before.
Yeah.
Several times.
Uh-huh.
I mean, this is the 1985 cover. And then when you first started, it's like, wow, it's the same thing as yesterday. It's like, this used to be so baffling and complicated. And it's like, well, when is she going to get started? Because that's so basic. Mm-hmm. I can't explain it, but it's still like really basic because I've read it probably...
This is a good.
And you were going. It's like okay, he's saying the same thing she said. It's like, okay. Oh, the question is the answer. To borrow that old Zen thing. The process of starting to think about how to get started is the start.
Mm-hmm.
As startling as that.
Yeah. Now, y'all are here because you have already started. You may not know it, but you've already started. The idea of coming to a class on Kabbalah would not have occurred to you if there wasn't something that you needed to know. And maybe what you needed to know is it's just not for me. But maybe what you needed to, but on the other hand, perhaps after, you know, listen to me blab for a couple of hours, you decide, well, this is not at all what I thought it was, and this is going to be it for me. Perhaps a year from now, 2 or 3 years from now, a door will open and Kabbalah will be on the other side, and something that was said here today will suddenly snap into focus. I can almost guarantee you that something will ring a bell at some point in your career if you continue to pursue a path of wisdom along these lines.
And it often happens when you're in an unlikely place, like standing in a shower.
Yeah. There you go. Shower, yeah. Uh-huh. Bus stops, you know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In the rain.
On that note, mm-hmm. I thank you all very kindly for coming today.
Thank you.
Thank you.